Okay. So how many of you, can you hear me okay? Is it, okay. How many of you have heard or read the legend of Angulimala? Higher. Okay, so about two-thirds of you. So this will be interesting because it's a different version. And Susan Orr gave me this book. It's called The Buddha and the Terrorist. And it's a different take on the story of Angulimala. And Angulimala, traditionally in the Pali canon in Majjhima Nikaya 86, is a mass murderer. And in the story, in the Pali canon, it is said that he was a brilliant student, and the other students were jealous of him, and so they went to their teacher and said, this guy wants to take over, and he wants to take your spot, and you better do something about it. And so the teacher decided he'll get rid of him by saying, what you have to do is kill 1,000 people and take a finger off every person and wear it around your neck. And me as your teacher is telling you to do this, so you have to do it. So that's the version in the Pali Canon. There's also versions that it was jealous students who had him do it. Another version is he had an affair with the teacher's wife, and the teacher had him do this to get him in trouble. Another Vajrayana version, he was a tantric practitioner, and he went around killing people because I don't know why. I have no idea why. In this book by Satish Kumar, it is a different version that I hadn't heard of, but in his introduction, he said this is what he learned in India from his mother. And in this version, Angulimala is of the Dalit class, and the Dalits are the untouchables. And even in the Buddha's time, there was a class of people that just did the grunt work, weren't allowed to advance in society and weren't treated well. And Satish Kumar starts the story by saying, you have to know that there's three types of leadership styles. And he said the first type is those who lead by violence, by threat, by threatening to make your life miserable if you don't do what I say. Examples in history, I'm sure you all know Hitler, Genghis Khan, Napoleon, Osama bin Laden. No, I'm not going to say that. I'm not getting political. And then there are those who follow the path of nonviolence. And we all can name those. Mahatma Gandhi, the Buddha, Jesus, who else? Martin Luther King, yes. And then there's a third type, and this is where Angulimala fits in. And this is the type that experience violence, cause violence, and saw the error of their ways and did a complete turnaround. And examples of this are King Ashoka in India, considered the greatest king India ever had, probably one of the greatest leaders of all times. St. Paul on the road to Damascus for Christian background. It's what happened to him when he saw this wasn't working, this violent attitude. The Prophet Muhammad, he started out as a fairly violent person too and then saw this isn't helping anybody. And he changed as well. Malcolm X, another one. Angulimala fits in this third category of somebody who committed some atrocious acts and saw the error of their ways. So In this version of the Buddha and the Terrorist, Angulimala is born into the lowest caste of society. In the book, they call him Doms, but I believe in India they're called Dalit people. And his name at birth was Ahimsika. Ahimsika means one who is peaceful or one who is harmless. Satish Kumar argues in this book that this story is probably the most accurate because a Brahmin would not have been called the harmless one, which is interesting because in the Pali Canon, not just in Majjhima Nikaya 86, but in the Jataka Tales and the Theragata, they talk about Ahimsika and him being called the harmless one. So in this, the book opens with the Buddha being begged by a woman called Nandini not to go into the forest near Savati, India, because there is a mass murderer who's been wandering around the forest and he is killing people. In this version, only 100 people, but he takes 10 fingers. So not of 1,000 people taking one, but 100 people taking 10 fingers. Angulimala actually means, Anguli means 1,000 fingers, and mala means necklace. So necklace of 1,000 fingers. So the Buddha is told, don't go into the forest. Angulimala's there. He's on a killing spree, and he might kill you. In this book, it's a woman, Nandini, who is the one to warn the Buddha. I actually looked up Nandini, Googled her, Wikipedia, no such person. So this is, it seems to me that what Kumar is doing is putting all the people who warn the Buddha into one person, you know, poetic license, so to speak. And so the Buddha encounters Angulimala, and he is not upset by it. In the book, it said, you know, if it's my time to die, it's my time to die. I'm not going to live my life in fear. And Angulimala says, well, you should fear me because you are going to be my 100th victim, and I am going to kill you. And he starts running after the Buddha, and this is from the Pali Canon. Then the Blessed One willed a feat of psychic powers such that Angulimala, though running with all his might, could not catch up with the Blessed One, walking at a normal pace. Then the thought occurred to Angulimala, this is amazing. This is outstanding. In the past, I've chased and seized even a swift-running elephant, a swift-running horse, a swift-running chariot, a swift-running deer. But now, even though I'm running with all my might, I can't catch up with this contemplative, walking at normal pace. So he stopped and called out to the Blessed One, stop, contemplative, stop. And the Buddha said, I have stopped, Angulimala, once and for all, having cast off violence toward all living beings. You, though, are unrestrained toward beings. That's how I have stopped. Excuse me. And you haven't. And this is from the book, the Buddha says, I know you can kill me, and maybe you will. But when you kill none other than yourself, because I am none other than you, and you are none other than me. Whatever you do to me, you do to yourself, Angulimala. Let me tell you one thing. You are capable not only of killing, you are also capable of loving. You are capable of compassion. You are capable of change. You are capable of friendship. And then later on, as Angulimala is amazed by this person who's speaking to him like this, the Buddha says, I know you have suffered at the hands of higher castes, the rich and the powerful. There is cruelty in the world, but cruelty cannot be dissolved by cruelty. Oppression cannot be ended by oppression. Fire cannot be put out with more fire. Overcome cruelty with compassion, hatred with love, and injustice with forgiveness. Stop traveling this road of hatred and violence. That is true stopping. So Angulimala is absolutely amazed at this, at what this person is saying to him, not afraid, and he begins to wake up. It makes sense to him. There's a parable that you, I think, have all heard about karma, and karma being equated to salt in a glass of water. If you had not done good in your life, or if you believe in previous lifetimes, it would be like pouring salt into a glass of water. You would taste it immediately. But if you had been doing good in your life and in all other lifetimes, it would be like pouring salt into a lake. You wouldn't even begin to taste it, because the good karma would so outweigh the bad. And apparently that was the case with Angulimala. He immediately saw the error of his ways. He immediately said, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be in pain anymore. I want to follow a path that causes the least amount of suffering for myself and every other living being. And this is also in the Pali Canon. The Buddha made him his attendant. Now, those of you who have been here for a while and have read the Pali Canon, Ananda is a well-known attendant for the Buddha, but apparently before Ananda was Angulimala. And then he was called Ahimsaka, the nonviolent one, the one who conquered the terrorist within. So this is from this So the Buddha completely accepts Angulimala and sees the true Buddha nature in him. But unfortunately, King Pasenadi, who was king at the time, king of Savati, was out looking for Angulimala with 500 of his warriors. They planned on killing him. And he rides up to the Buddha with this army he has with him and says, have you seen Angulimala? And the Buddha said, yes, I have. And he said, well, where is he? And he said, what if I were to tell you that he has adopted nonviolence, that he has taken on the monk's robe, and he has sworn to do only good in the world? What would you say? And King Pasenadi would say, I don't believe you. That's impossible. That wouldn't ever happen. And the Buddha said, well, it did happen. In fact, this is Angulimala, who is now Ahimsaka, and points to the monk next to him. And the king kind of backs up and goes, he's a dangerous man. And the Buddha said, no, he's not. He's not dangerous at all. And this is from the book. True forgiveness and compassion come only when one is able to forgive even those who have committed barbaric acts. If Angulimala is capable of renouncing violence, then tell me, Your Majesty, is your civilized society also capable of being truly civilized and renouncing violence? That's a pretty heavy statement. So, Ahimsaka is allowed to live as a Buddhist monk with the Buddha and his entourage. But as you know, he has to go into a village and beg for alms. This is how monks and nuns lived then, from the generosity of the lay people. And so Ahimsaka goes into the village looking for alms, and somebody recognizes him, even though he's now got a shaved head and doesn't have a beard and is wearing monk's robes. They said, there's the murderer. There's the one who killed our relatives. What are we going to do? And they start stoning him. And they berate him and they rip his robes and tell him, don't ever come back. And he leaves the village and he goes back to the monastery, to the monks and to the Buddha. And he said, they don't want me in this village. They hate me because of what I've done. They don't know that I am not that person at all anymore. And the Buddha said, monk, bear it. That was it. Monk, bear it. He had to work out the last of his karma, and the last of his karma was having to put up with people who hated him, who didn't want him around. But there was no getting out of it. He had to bear it. So Angulimala goes back into the village, and he sets an example of how it is to bear it. And even the people in the village were impressed by his attitude, his calmness, his demeanor, and his love for them, even though they had hated him for what he had done in their village. In the book, he goes to the village and wants to ask forgiveness of the people there. I found that interesting because if any of you been to my forgiveness talk, there is no asking for forgiveness in Buddhism. Karma can't be forgiven. You can be pardoned, but you can't be forgiven. Now, for any of us who have forgiven others, you can do that for yourself, for your own satisfaction and for your own hope and heart, but karma can't be forgiven. So anyway, that was interesting that it was in the book. However, and this is from the Bala Pandita Sutta, which means fools and wise people, and this is from the Buddha. Monks, there are these two are fools. Which two? The one who doesn't see his transgression as a transgression, and the one who doesn't rightfully pardon another who has confessed his transgression. These two are fools. These two are wise people. Which two? The one who sees his transgression as a transgression, and the one who rightfully pardons another who has confessed his transgression. These two are wise people. So while we cannot clear karma in others, we can clear it in ourselves by not holding hatred in our hearts. So back to the book. So he's, you know, stoned when he goes into the village, but he keeps going in. And he, because of his patience and forbearance, he completely wakes up. He becomes an arhant. An arhant is an awakened being. And he has so much compassion in his heart for people in the village that at one point he goes in the village and he sees a pregnant woman who is having a lot of trouble giving birth. And it troubles him greatly. He doesn't want to see somebody in that much pain. He goes back to the Buddha and says, there's a woman and she's in childbirth, and in some books they say maybe it was a breech birth, but anyway, she was in horrible pain. He said, I don't know what to do. I want to help her. And the Buddha says to go back to the woman and say this to him, sister, since I was born, I do not recall intentionally killing a living being. Through this truth, may there be well-being for you, well-being for your fetus. And Angulimala pointed out that wouldn't be true for him to say that. I find this is really interesting, and I have no explanation for why the Buddha said that. I have no idea. But the Buddha then offered this revised stanza. Sister, since I was born with a noble birth, which means he became a monk, I do not recall intentionally killing a living being. Through this truth, may there be well-being for you and well-being for your fetus. Now, I read one commentary and it said the Buddha was making a wordplay here. Born mean, you know, being born as a monk, as a person who would not commit violence. So maybe, but why he would say that first one, I don't know. But it's interesting, in Theravadan countries, this statement is called an act of truth, or the Angulimala Parita. And I went online and I found all kinds of chants based on this. They're protection chants for people who are ill, for women who are giving birth, for new households. And they're beautiful chants that go on for like half an hour. It's also called an act of truth. And after performing this act of truth, he was known to bring safety to the people of Savati, and he was revered. So at last, his earlier name, Ahimsaka, finally really benefited from him, as he completely denounced causing harm to anybody and would only show compassion. And according to the Pali Canon, he appears to have died soon after he joined the order. So he went from a murderer to a protector of the most vulnerable in society. A remarkable turnaround. So lessons from the story of Angulimala, and I've thought about this a lot and wrote down my thoughts, but I'm curious to know, what lessons do you think are here by this legend? And maybe it's true and maybe it's not, I don't know, but what lessons do you get out of hearing about Angulimala? And Fred back there has speakers or whatever we call them.
Thank you. From the deepest, most horrible pain that someone can experience, Angulimala's suffering as a murderer, it's a very painful way to live, causing harm to the innocent. And from that depth, or from that darkness, comes the light. And the light is to be aware of the pain and the suffering that's being caused, and to also be aware that there is another way. It doesn't have to be painful. It doesn't have to be something that's causing suffering, but something that's causing compassion and kindness. And so he had to go to the darkest and the most painful in order to arise into the most compassionate, the most tender, loving way for a human being to be. I don't know that there's a better story to talk about the experience of pain and suffering and moving from that to a place of kindness, loving kindness. Well, I've experienced it myself, so you could put my name in that book and you would be telling the story of Raphael. Mm-hmm. And from it, I'm able to experience the tears of sorrow. And to move from that place to experience the tears of joy, seeing someone in a happy way, in a peaceful way, in a kind, loving way, to be able to receive that, to give it.
Anyone else have any comments on this? Yeah.
There's nothing that can't be turned around. Circumstance, no past, no burden that can't be turned around.
Yep. I think that's a wonderful lesson from here. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah. Margaret.
But to me, part of it too is that doesn't mean it's easy. I mean, when he goes back to town and is stoned, you go to jail by stopping. And so then that's another layer you have to deal with. And that strikes me as being quite true. You, as opposed to the other tales of forgiveness in more in the Christian tradition, where it's all beauty and light. And in fact, no, you've got other steps to take. But I agree that the point is, you can always stop doing what was harmful,
yeah,
and start again.
I think the Buddha's very blunt advice, bear it. I find that really, I don't know, helpful, because how many of us have been in situations and this isn't fair, you know, this shouldn't be happening to me. I did everything right and look what's happening. Bear it. You know, I mean, what else is there to do? Come out the other end and learn something from it, but that's just the way it is right now.
Version of the story I remember is the Buddha said bear it, because being hit with rocks is nothing compared that would be there otherwise, and just by turning his life around.
You know, something, we might be running out of batteries or something, because, yeah, it's cutting in and out.
All right, there I am.
No, it isn't.
The part of the story that I was related to the most was when he was dealing with the woman who was in childbirth, and at the same time that you were describing that, I was thinking about what he'd done previously, where he'd killed all of these people, presumably, in presumably pretty horrible ways. And then in dealing with the, you know, obviously he had dealt with the moment of death for all of those people, but he was concerned about the moment of life for this one woman.
Wow.
And maybe this is a little simplistic view, but I keep going back in the Buddhist philosophy to the doctrine of impermanence and interdependence. When he was killing everybody, he had no relationship to the effects that he was having to other people. So he wasn't relating to the interdependence. But of course, that was a period of time of his life when he was, you know, that was going on, moving forward and passing. And then he gets up to this next point of his life, and, you know, now he's relating to the effects that he has, or the effects he can have. And now that's a much more powerful, much more strong effect on him. But it's also an impermanent moment. As you know, as you said, you didn't understand why the Buddha would say, make the comment to tell this person. Hopefully that phrase would actually help her. I don't know if it would. But to say that you've never hurt anybody. And I think that kind of goes back to the interdependence and impermanence section again. It's like, if in that moment, if the best thing that you can do is tell somebody that, even if it's a lie, and it helps them, then you're taking responsibility for the effect that you're having in that moment. In the same way that later on, when the effects of his past came back to haunt him, he had to deal with those at that time. It just seems like all of that, if you look at it in a very finite manner, makes sense. No, just a thought.
I think it's an interesting thought, because according to the teachings, the one precept that a bodhisattva never breaks is lying. In all lifetimes. So that's why this area really confused me, that he would say that, and maybe it's a translation from the Pali or something, but it did strike me as being odd. You know, one of the lessons I thought about was also King Pasenadi, who really wanted to punish him, wanted to execute him, wanted to make his life miserable. And the Buddha said, you know, you're just going to keep this cycle of violence going on. And I started thinking about it. And just think in terms of Thailand and the monks there who are encouraging violence against the Rohingya, because they say the Rohingya who are Muslims violated Buddhists, you know, 500 years prior. And of course, if the Rohingya have any power after what's happened to them, they're going to want to get their revenge on the Buddhists for doing that. And then it goes on and on and on. It just doesn't stop till somebody says, stop, as the Buddha said, I have stopped. Are you going to stop? And for me, that was one of the most important lessons of this. Just when are you going to stop? Anybody else have anything they want to add before I do a diatribe on my stuff?
I have to say it. And it's coming from my own tradition, okay. But the born again piece is not from that tradition. But it's like the elephant in the middle of the living room. So I wanted to address that because the Buddha seems to imply that he has been born again. I'm not talking about the Christian sense. So I want to get that out of the way. But I'm talking about in the sense that he has accepted a new life. He's chosen a new path. And to me, I don't think it's lying. I think it's saying, I am a new person. I have changed. And since I've been this new person, I have not killed. And I don't see that as lying at all. So,
thank you. Thank you, Laura. I think that's a... Actually, in the book, they say he is born again, and they use that phrase.
Yeah,
and
that whole thing happens around birth. So
yeah,
there's a metaphor there. So
thank you. I think that's good. Anybody else? All right.
Thank you. Putting it in everyday life, it seems to me so often when I say, but I said I'm sorry, obligates you to forgive me and you to change, where it really only means I'm sorry and it's my obligation to change.
Great point. Really good point. And you also think about how you feel when you hate versus how you feel when you forgive or pardon, however you want to put it. What a difference in your own mind and in your own heart when you can let it go, let it be. Really hard thing to do. But I've been collecting stories for a long time of people who have learned to, okay, that's the way it was then. It doesn't mean I have to respond in the same manner. My favorite one that I think I've told you all, and forgive me because I tend to repeat myself at my old age now, is the South African woman when they were doing reconciliation and after apartheid, and a white man had killed both her husband and her son, and she was up there to speak her piece. And they said, if you could do anything to this man, what would you want to do? And she said, what I would want him to do, I want him ordered to come to my house every Sunday so I can make him dinner like I did my husband. And I want him to take me to church every week. That's actually what they ordered him to do. So she had lost her loved ones, but she wasn't going to live with that hatred. Instead, she forgave and she wanted peace in her own heart. That's a true story. And it's one of my favorite ones to tell in prison as well. Another thing that I got out of this is no one is eternally anything. You know, we think somebody is always good or always bad. We're constantly changing according to causes and conditions. Most of us just kind of accept it, but hopefully in this path, in this practice, we start seeing what's taking place and are responsible by being in the present moment and taking control of what we're doing rather than just reacting. At least that's our hope. And the story of Angulimala is a really great tale to show the ability and the potential to change no matter what. I wouldn't go into prison as I've been doing for 15 years if I didn't see people change. You know, if nobody changed, I wouldn't bother. Who would? But you see people who have remorse, who wish they hadn't done what they'd done, who are hoping to get back into society and make a difference. And the vast majority have said, I want to give back. I want to give back. I want to show that I am a good person. I did some really bad things, but I really want to prove that I can do some really good things as well. I had read this about that. Has anybody heard of the Milgram experiments at Yale? You want to tell it, Bob?
It was this kind of experiments that the psychologists did where they created like a prison environment and they had people shock people they didn't know, and people are screaming, and there's a professor there who's saying, no, we have to do this, you know, this is part of the protocol. And so it's used to show how easy it is for normal people to painful things to other people when there's some authority figure telling them that it's okay to take the responsibility for it. So I think that's pretty much what happened.
Yeah, and these were just normal college men, and you know, they were as surprised as anybody that they would actually keep doing this when people were not really screaming in pain, but acting like they were. They were giving lethal shocks because they were told to in the experiment. This was also part of the defense at the Eichmann trial, the Nazi trial after World War II, that this could take place. Anybody, you know, under the right circumstances, might act in ways that are abhorrent to anybody else. People involved in gangs, that's what they do. Gang leader says do something and they do it. They regret it later, but that's the mentality. No different than this experiment with these college students. I like this one a lot. Are we clinging to a fixed view when we get angry? How often are we just clinging to, but that's not the way it is, and I don't like it, and we have our view, and we're sticking to it. One of my favorite stories on this is Ram Dass, who during the first Gulf War put a picture of the first Bush president on his meditation table. And he did this so he would get over his anger. And he would look at him every day along with a statue of the Buddha and constantly think, but this person can change too. This is a human being. Due to causes and condition, this is what he's doing. There is no reason to hate him. Doesn't mean you don't do everything to stop something that you don't believe in, but it doesn't mean you have to hate. And there's a big difference. I was rather upset over what happened to Sarah Huckabee at the restaurant. I thought, this is tit for tat. You know, something else is going to happen. You can still be kind, even if you don't agree with somebody. And I know a lot of my friends disagree with me on this, but it made me very uncomfortable that she was treated like that. I had just read in the New York Times about Jimmy Fallon apparently was really roughed up by Trump, saying some pretty horrible things about him. I don't remember what it was, but it was addressed. And what did he do? He gave a huge amount of money to Immigrant Defense Fund. That's what he did in response. Well, Trump has nothing to scream about with this guy, because what's to scream about? He gave money to a defense fund. That is saying, I've stopped. When will you stop? That's skillful action. Doing what you believe, but not escalating violence. Another one, the Barrett, you can't fight karma. You know, a lot of us have done some fairly nasty things in our lives, and they catch up with you eventually. I think that all the time when something that I think is unfair, I think about all the times I was unfair. All right, bear it. This is what's happening. It's okay. It's all right. You most likely did exactly the same thing to somebody else. This is from Joseph Goldstein. This was just one of those tricycle thought things that come over, and I read the whole article because I was impressed with it. People sometimes wonder whether reflecting upon the law of karma will lead to feelings of guilt for past unwholesome actions. Guilt is a manifestation of condemnation or aversion towards oneself, which does not understand the changing, transformative quality of mind. It solidifies a sense of self by being non-forgiving. Understanding the law of karma leads us to reflect wisely on the skillfulness or unskillfulness of our actions. In the infinite time of our births, through all the realms of existence, we have done so many different kinds of actions, wholesome, unwholesome. In view of karmic law, guilt is an inappropriate feeling and a rather useless burden. Everybody agree with that or not? I'm seeing blank looks. I don't know. I've talked about this. I talked to, when I went on a monastic retreat with Ajahn Suchito about this and clearing karma, and he said there's 5 steps to clear karma. And he said the first one is admit fully the harm that you have caused, which is hard enough in itself when we've harmed somebody else or another sentient being, to admit fully what has taken place. Investigate the emotion that drove you to do this action. There's something behind it. Fear, jealousy, anger, whatever it is. Use the antidote for that emotion whenever it appears. So as you know, for anger, it's metta. This is what Angulimala Ahimsaka did. Instead of fear and anger when he was being stoned, he had compassion. And he developed that. Create a clear intention that the harmful act will never be repeated again. And finally, forgive yourself, and if appropriate, ask forgiveness of others. And sometimes it's not appropriate because other people might have so much anger that you will just make things worse. So that's something this is what we talk about in prison a lot, when people want to be forgiven and they want to ask for forgiveness. And it's not always the best thing to do. There's still a lot of hatred and animosity going on. You're not going to get the answer that you want many times. I've told you about Eddie Paragas, and who wanted desperately to be forgiven and wrote to his victim's family. And they said, pretty much, we'll see you burn in hell first. That wasn't what he wanted to hear, even though he'd spent 35 years in prison perfecting himself. You just don't know. You do what you can. And don't worry about everybody else. Yeah.
I have a question on guilt. Yeah. If the first step is seeing very clearly what the harm that you did and experiencing, feeling that and understanding it, and then guilt can be a part of it. It's more not getting stuck in guilt, right?
Actually, what Ajahn Suchito said is remorse is appropriate. Remorse is always appropriate. Guilt is a wasted emotion because you don't do anything. It's like anger. You just wallow in it. Remorse is action behind it. Yeah. Another thing I thought about is through understanding, well, compassion. One reason we hate is we don't see the reasoning behind or the reason for other people's situation. You know, how many, I've been using this a lot. You see a homeless person and they've asked you for money and initially maybe, oh, they're just going to spend it on booze or they're going to do this or that or the other thing. Whether you give or not, how did they end up like this? What happened? What is their background? I mean, instead of just going to view, actually thinking about there were causes and conditions that caused this person to be where they are. And can you have compassion for that? And finally, hatred never ceases with hatred, as it says in the Dhammapada. Only through non-hatred. Now, it doesn't say love. Now, I get on this, I harp on this all the time. It says non-hatred. So, you're not going to love everybody. I think it'd be wonderful if you could. I know I can't, and in this lifetime, I won't. But you can not wish anybody harm. You can wish the best for them. You can do that no matter who it is. So that's my thing. Does anybody have any comments or their own thoughts on all of this? Well, if you don't, then we're going to be leaving 10 minutes early after I read this. The final, this comes from the Pali Canon, and it is what Ahimsaka said. And I edited it down because it's quite long, but I think it's appropriate. This was after he had completely woken up. Who once was heedless, but later not, brightens the world like the moon set free from a cloud. His evil done deed is replaced with skillfulness. He brightens the world. May even my enemies hear talk of the Dhamma. May even my enemies devote themselves to the Buddha's teaching. May even my enemies associate with those people who, peaceful, good, encourage others to accept the Dhamma. May even my enemies hear the Dhamma time and again from those who advise endurance, forbearance, who praise non-opposition, and may they follow it. Doer of no harm is my name, Ahimsaka, but I used to be a doer of harm. Today I am true to my name, for I no longer harm anyone at all. So that's the end. So may you be forgiving, and may you forgive yourself, and may you also stop if there's any hatred in your heart. Just stop. Thank you all for coming.